Hey, hope you're enjoying the Grave Talks. Each and every week, we're now giving you two brand new episodes every Monday and Tuesday. Today and every Wednesday, we're going to flash back to some of our favorite interviews of the past. To listen to our complete archive of episodes, along with commercial-free advanced episodes of the show months before they're released to the public, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. It's only $5. You sign up now at patreon.com/thegravetalks or follow the links at thegravetalks.com. Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from The Grave Talks. If you're liking this program, I invite you to become a Grave Keeper. That is a supporter of this program. You are the folks who will financially allow this show to continue going forward. $5 a month gets you access to advanced episodes of the show as I create them. Typically 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes even more episodes in advance available exclusively for our Grave Keeper members. Plus, exclusive interview segments that are not going to be available to the public, only to gravekeepers. Typically an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes of interview time with future guests of our show going forward. It's exclusive content, it's advanced content, and it's only for gravekeepers who are helping to keep this show on the air. It takes a tremendous amount of time every single week for me to put this show together, get it up, get it on the air, have it hosted, bandwidth, all of that. And I love doing it, but we do need to make sure it's financially viable, in at least to support the costs of running this thing. So if you like the show, please consider becoming a Gravekeeper through our website, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month, get advanced access and exclusive content as well to keep this show on the air. Thank you for your support. I hope you enjoy it just as much as I do. Check it out, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. And thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. Oftentimes, institutions or former prisons that we discuss here on The Grave Talks are long-forgotten relics that no longer house the living. The Kentucky State Penitentiary breaks that mold. Today, the behemoth known as the Castle on the Cumberland still houses hundreds of inmates and staff working to keep the worst of society behind its walls. Quite a feat for a structure completed in 1886 and still running to this day. The Kentucky State Penitentiary is still home to Kentucky's death row inmates and houses the execution facility. And as we're about to learn, still is home to many inmates, both living and the dead. Steve Asher knows this all too well, as he was employed there as an officer for many years and experienced the best and the worst society has to offer. And also the best and the worst that the undead have to offer.
Okay, what you have to understand is, this part of Western Kentucky, and Kentucky in general, especially this area, we are very close to Missouri and also Southern Illinois, and we're maybe an hour from Nashville. We're 45 minutes or so from Clarksville. So we're more Midwestern than we are really deep South. But like a lot of the South, we were hammered in the Civil War and actually didn't join the fighting until later part of the battle, when it was kind of like you were kind of getting your hind end handed to you from both sides, and you're like, well, I guess I'm going to pick the home team. You know, it's generally rough on a border state to kind of stay neutral, and there's a lot of people that follow this that don't even consider that Kentucky as part of the secession. But the reason I say that is we had nothing. The land was razed and just in horrific shape. So when time come for General Lyon, which is where Lyon County is, where the prison is, that was one of the things, one of the concessions that was made, that they could put a prison there. And understand, there was nothing. The whole area was just on starvation rations, and people were just in horrible shape, demoralized. And this gave the area something to kind of pour its energy into and kind of a work project. As it were, you know, like as you might see, take to different depressed areas and and try to do that. And that's really how it started. It was already a horrifically bad situation. A lot of death had happened in that area. And the area where the penitentiary was built, it's now called Edible, but it actually should have been called New Edible. The area that was Old Edible is now under thousands of gallons of water because they dammed up this part of Western Kentucky to run, you have electrical power and whatnot. Kind of like if you've ever seen Brother, Where Art Thou, where they flooded and knocked down all the buildings and all that.
Sure.
That connects to the land between the lakes area, which is right across the water, which is a whole nother story. But when the advent of the penitentiary began, it went online. It started, I think, in 1884, 85. It took a few years. There were Italian stonemasons that came in. They were trying to model it on the Juliet prison, like the early Juliet prison, which was more of a Gothic style, you know, with the kind of turrets and all that, which, you know, some people would say, well, no, you know, it's maybe not as Gothic as some places. Okay, but, you know, potato, potato. For me, it's pretty freaking Gothic. I mean, all it needed was some bats. I mean, it's got the spires and all that. And the bricks were being laid down by inmates. They would bring in inmates from, I believe it was Lexington, which was where the original penitentiary was, and they brought there and they used inmate labor to lay all the stones. And it was backbreaking labor. I mean, you know, they call it labor for a reason, but, you know, and it was in the time of going, well, that's just a dirty inmate. What's it matter? Love them, hate them, or indifferent. You know, it was brutal. It was brutal work, and a lot of people would lose hands, and just reportedly people died in the processes of making the wall. So literally pain and anguish went into the construction of the everything from the initial, you know, flooring to everything, you know, all the mortar work. And so for me, that really set the tone for it. I mean, just in the name itself, a penitentiary, it's not a boys' camp. It's not there to teach these guys some sort of usable skill. It was there for isolation. It was there for punishment. And it was there for, more or less, you excise these people from the community. You know, and that's what you found there. And the concept of, you know, seen and not heard, and very much a lockstep controlled movement, all this on top of people who are volatile anyway, on top of, you know, taking anyone who's, you know, say even an upstanding citizen, you take them away from their family. I mean, you know, there's been experiments where they would put just regular folks in situations where some were guards or corrections officers, whatever you want to call them, and others in the position of the inmate, of the subjugated class, and there's going to be back and forth. And that's, you know, just from day one, that's how it started, and it's pretty much stayed that way ever since.
How long did it take to build a facility?
I think it went online Christmas Eve, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have my papers in front of me, but I believe it was 1889. Yeah, Christmas Eve, 1889. And it even had a little plaque in front of it. It said, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." I mean, it really set the tone for, you're not in Kansas anymore. And it was a battlefield. I mean,
sure.
more or less a gladiator pit.
Who were some of the first inmates there once this thing was constructed? Did they come in from other facilities? Where did the population originate from?
Well, it obviously, of course, they're going to have, you know, some of the worst, and we do the same. If you try to break up, the concept was, okay, well, you have a cell of people that are in gangs or that are stronger inmates, you break them up, you put them in different facilities, but it's kind of like breaking off a stem off a well-growing plant. You put it over here, and there's put it in a position where they can latch on to stuff. You basically grow another plant. So what they did was they more or less helped build better crime in a way by doing that. But it varied. It could have been anybody from someone who didn't want to fight in the war to somebody who, you know, stole a horse, because obviously this is back in the days, you know, they would hang a man, you know, for stealing a horse or cattle. To, you know, I've heard stories of there having been children in there, you know, for whatever reason. Maybe they were starving, they stole apples or bread or something like that, or, you know, just anything. There was no class. I'm sorry, I was just saying, there was no classifications in regards of, you know, where and how you place people. It was like, good luck.
It was
just welcome to Thunderdome.
Everybody for themselves, and murderers all the way down to you stole the apple pie down the road.
Right. I mean, it was just, it was a thing like, and I try to explain it to people, and of course, I'm looking at it through a different prism because I was not in that time. Now, I was the youngest of a couple who were Depression-era children, and even coming through something like that, when times are very lean, times, it's like, look, in a time of lawlessness, laws were extremely hard. I mean, what laws were there? Were there because, you know, they had to keep some semblance of, well, civility and control. Mm-hmm. And have, you know, a lot of times people have to have that fear factor to go, well, I'm not going to do this. I mean, you know, I kind of joke, but I mean, look at like the Purge, you know, if people just said, you know, smoke them if you got them, have at it. You know, there'd be people who'd be blood on the bricks like 5 minutes. It's just the nature of it. That's how people are. Not to say that people are purely wicked, but sometimes people overall need some sort of control measures to kind of keep them on the tracks.
Sure. And this facility, what's really interesting about this is we talked to so many folks about different places, properties, buildings, structures, institutions all over the country. Oftentimes they're empty today. They're vacant. The people have left them long ago. But this structure, correct, is still very much in use.
Oh yes, it's churning along. I mean, yeah. That's the thing. I'm not for sure exactly where you're based in your state.
Branson.
Okay, like if you people talk about, say, Vegas or something, of course, I mean, they're going to think of town, you know, areas like, if you think of Kentucky, you think of horse racing, right? Or maybe Lexington or Louisville, one of the larger metropolitan hubs. Mm-hmm. Well, we are in Western Kentucky, and, you know, it's one of those deals where, you know, we'll slice the slice of bread three ways. I mean, we'll get the most we can get out of any situation. And that's how it was. I mean, there's been a lot of changes. When they implemented the ACA, which had to do with the class, the way that a prison is set up, to where it's like, okay, look, you can't put a man in a 3x2 cell where he can't stand up and there's no running water, or I mean, he's sitting there, he has to be allowed a certain amount of time to bathe, and he can't be laying in his own filth and whatnot. Not to say there's not some funky guys in there, because good Lord, I've worked with some, but it's a deal where when certain accreditations come along, they had to change at the time, which at one time they would have several men in one cell, a smaller cell, and then they would have, you know, well over like, I think, 1,200 or more. Well, once they said, well, we have to change the cells, which means we're going to have to decrease the population and or build more buildings, then, you know, it went to like double cells, and then finally eventually went to single cells. And that was just the nature of it. I mean, once it started kind of changing a little bit, obviously there's things you're still not going to change. A murderer is going to be a murderer, and putting a person in a pen, it's still a pen. You can make it as nice as however as you can, and that's great, but you're still not changing the fact that these men will be isolated and left kind of to their own means.
Sure. How did your interest first begin with this building and the structure, and what drew you to it? What's your story with it?
Well, my family, especially on my mom's family, they were coming from the Appalachians. My mom's family were mainly French, who landed in that area, and they had a very rich oral history. My father's side of the family was English and German, very superstitious, and both sides had all kinds of kooky stories and this and that. Well, growing up, I would hear stories from my father, who back in the 1950s, worked at the penitentiary. And, you know, my dad was raised quite rough. His father actually was an inmate at the same penitentiary back in the probably late 30s or 40s. He was a bootlegger. And he would, I think he was a counterfeiter. He actually made his own money. He could, like, hand draw. Yes, he was actually very talented, which, you know, I don't have that kind of talent, but hopefully I got a little bit of that from him. And I would hear all these stories from my dad. And, you know, it sort of kind of pumped, it kind of built it up. Now, as I told you off air, you know, I've done everything from construction work. I've done radio work. whatever, factory work, all this is kind of stuff before working in the prison systems. And now I work with special needs adults, teaching them life skills. But, you know, it always stuck in my head. And when I got a little bit older, started a family, you know, radio didn't really pay a whole lot, at least in this market. So one of the jobs that is always there, they've not closed the doors in hundreds of years, is the penitentiary. And they had, at least then, some type of decent medical, you know, insurance for your family. And you pretty much know, you know, they're not going to shut the doors. And, you know, they'll hire you. Just, you know, do the job. Don't bring nothing in. Don't bring nothing out. And get the same count, head count, before you leave, and everything's dandy. And so once I actually started working at the penitentiary, it was, I treated it kind of twofold. Obviously, it's my job, and I have to do it competently. But I used it as sort of my own freehand to kind of walk through and do almost a sociological study of these people, and due to the fact that I had been interested in the paranormal since when I was a young child. I had had some experiences as a young kid, and I wouldn't call myself sensitive, but I definitely have a pretty good gut in regards of feeling when things are off or weird. Call it what you want. But so I was able to kind of do sort of a non-official little investigations wherever the different spots that I worked, which, and I did see a few things there. And as I spoke to other officers, and they kind of knew that I wasn't squirrely and I was competent, because, you know, some, just the facts are, you know how this is. Sometimes folks will see spooks behind every corner. They're going to see Jerry Garcia in their toast or whatever. And it's just, you know, you have to kind of vet people, and they had to get a feel for you too. Well, after they realized that, or felt that I was somewhat competent, people would kind of go, well, yeah, that is kind of an odd area. And the old timers would kind of pipe up and go, yeah, I've seen a few things. And then once they know, yeah, well, Asher's okay, he won't laugh you out of the room and whatever, that kind of opened the floodgates. And then here come all these other officers. Even some of the ones that would kind of joke with the lieutenants and the captains, you know, because of course those guys aren't going to believe anything, because who wants to believe that, you know? But, and then they'd leave and say, hey, I'm sorry, I was giving you a hard time, but they would have laughed me out of the room, and I'm trying to get a sergeant position. But this is what I've seen. And that's how actually all the stories kind of come to me initially. And that's before I ever planned to write a book. I'm not a writer by education or really by vocation. It just sort of fell into my lap. And by the time that I had spoken to all these different people, I had several stories. And I'd spoke to a friend of mine who was working through Permuted Press, which is who carries my books right now. He said something about, well, hey, can I show this to my editor? And I'm like, sure, does he need a laugh? You know, I can do it in crayon if he wants to, you know, laugh harder, because I'm not a writer. I'm not a journalist by any stretch of the imagination. So he said, no, just humor me. He showed it to him, and, well, here it comes back. And he says, well, he would like to see your other stories and maybe put a book out. And I was kind of like, you know, Happy Gilmore? He says, no, I ain't no golfer. I'm a hockey player. You know, I'm a prison guard, or I'm this and that. I'm not a writer. He says, well, not yet. And I just, you know, I didn't have enough confidence, and just, I had never done it before. But by the time everything was said and done, and we went through all the phases, and they chipped the rocks, you know, the rough edges off of me, they had something that they felt was good enough to put out. And surprisingly, to me, most of all, people seemed to like it. But being in the South, you always have to be mindful of how you present stuff, which, you know, I'm not, you know, I always am mindful too that kids are around and that people, not just adults, read my books. So, you know, I always try to kind of watch the language, and also don't try to sell anything as this is 100% paranormal, or this is a ghost, or this is whatever. As I told you off air, I can't quantify that. And we can, you know, I've really not had anybody come back that we can just, you know, 100% verify to say, yeah, this is what's on the other side and these are what these are. All I can say is kind of like the old Dragnet thing. This is what I saw, he or she saw. This is what they felt they experienced, or this is the phenomenon and the different stimuli that they had. You know, make your own judgment. It's kind of one of those, I'm trying to think, kind of like a Twilight Zone deal. You know, this is what happened. Make of it what you want.
Before you started working there, had you heard rumblings, or were there rumors of it being haunted that you were aware of?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those, like, classic spook house looking things. I mean, you really should see this place. You know, if you're ever in this area, I would love to show you around it. And like I said, I mean, obviously I can't take you in there because it is still a functioning penitentiary. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like the second book, The Hauntings of the Western Lunatic Asylum, which was about Western State Hospital, which is in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which is, again, maybe 20, 30 minutes from where I live in Princeton, Kentucky. That, just like that, which is the same time period. It had been like a tuberculosis hospital. And it had, you know, orphans, all kinds of crazy stuff there. Fires that were set by inmates and just crazy stuff. It has its own, it has its own presence. It's kind of a, to kind of bring up like visions of like Rose Red, Stephen King's, you know, book, which I love King. He was like, he's my guy. You don't have to say a word. You don't have to tell a person about it. Just set them in front of it and they'll go, oh, you know, yeah, that's creepy. What, you know, you don't have to know a thing about it. Then you just, you feel the energy.
What were some of the first stories that you had heard about the ghosts there prior to working there and prior to hearing firsthand accounts and experiencing things firsthand of the penitentiary?
Wow. Yeah, let me see. Now, I mean, I've heard some things from my dad. I had heard that just before he had come to work there, there had been some sort of, I guess, uprising. And there was always a back and forth between the inmates and staff. And a staff supervisor told me, look, son, you know, they can take this hill anytime they want, because it's they call it the hill because it's sort of on, you know, on a big hill. They said they can take this hill anytime they want. I mean, believe we'll get it back, but there'll be blood, you know, for sure. So don't be mindful, you know, before you have to flex on somebody, think about it. And there had been a situation where there was a lieutenant, and apparently he had been really hard on some of these people. And I don't know if there had been a set-in or some sort of issue with the food in the kitchen. Generally, I don't know how much you know about penitentiaries, but you play with people's food, you play with people's visits or their mail, and you're going to have problems. And that's kind of what happened. And supposedly it was bad enough to the point that this LT was captured and beheaded. You know, I'd spoke to different people about it. I'd not ever seen anything official about it. But this was a story that, and, you know, my father, who's gone now, was not a guy who just made up stuff. He just wasn't a guy. He was just very straight. But, you know, he did have, you know, old stories of his family, but this is stuff that he said that they experienced. And he said there was times at night when you would come across the hill and you could swear that you would see what looked like an illuminated head at the top of the hill, where, come to find out, they supposedly stood the man's head facing the captain's office, which was down, kind of downwind from it, to where the people coming in would see it and go, okay, here's your message, straighten this out or there's going to be more heads on these steps. And, you know, which, it was one of those deals where when your dad tells you something like that, and I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, you know. But then I talked to other old timers and people that retired out of there and said, no, that's factual. That supposedly actually happened. And then you go in there yourself and you're down where the death house was. You're down where we had, now I understand this facility is so old. How old was it? It was so old. It had, you at one time, there was hangings, there was, I think, firing squad, there's the electric chair, and now there is lethal injection. And some of the inmates currently have the dubious honor of being grandfathered into the choice of, do you want to ride the lightning or do you want to just take the deep sleep? So, you know, how's that for a, I don't know, kind of a weird happenstance, sort of a nefarious honor. But yeah, there was a lot of stuff like that. I mean, a lot of shadows, a lot of people being pushed, stuff. You know, just the stuff you would think.
Yeah.
Cold chills, stuff being moved, people being threatened. There was a gurney that was down by the death house, and it would be hung up on the wall, lashed against the wall with straps, and people kept finding it unhooked. And you would sometimes have people come down, and they would hear it banging, hear something bang, 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 against the bulkhead of the door that goes out into the main hall, and they would find the gurney. And that was the one, you know, come to find out, that was a gurney that the guys that died in the electric chair was put on. Like, I mean, they were still smoking. It was like putting like a hot roast out right out of the right off the spit onto it. I mean, they were still smoking. And so I think there must have been some element of whatever fear and rage and uncertainty and electrical energy in the brain that was still sparking that maybe he got held into that. Because, I mean, as close as anything that I would say in regards of what is a ghost, what is this and that, I know we all have electrical energy. I know everything, all life has electrical energy. Even water, you know, running water supposedly creates a certain current. And the penitentiary is all built on limestone and has like a lot of quartz crystals and stuff like involved in it. And all that going under Western Kentucky, which is a karst system. A karst system is basically limestone based that's been hollowed through like Swiss cheese with a lot of aquifers running under that. So that energy plus that, plus negativity, plus the violence, plus the death, equated into paranormal activity or whatever you want to call that, some sort of energy remnant.
Yeah.
So that this is why people were seeing, like I said, you know, the dead walking around. This is why people are hearing people walk up inside of wall stands. This is the reason that they're seeing people in, you know, in the kitchen asking for seconds, stuff like that, and there's no one there.
Having knowledge of there being paranormal activity and obviously having knowledge of what the facility has been through and the inmates have been through and the staff and the officers have been through, obviously, probably the first time going through those doors, there's a lot of things going through your mind. But tell me, what was it like the first time you set foot there? What sort of feelings were you getting as far as, you know, emotional feelings about the building? Did you feel anything heavy in terms of paranormal, or was it more so just the heaviness of the knowledge you had of the history of the building? Tell me about that experience.
Well, you know, I'm sitting here trying to reflect on it. Obviously, yes, having a little foreknowledge of what's going on or what had been claimed, you know, that was there. But, you know, when I'm hands-on with people, it's kind of like one of those things like you almost get in a car wreck and then you don't really get scared until after you're, like, down the hill, like, man, I could have really went bad, you know. It was more of a thing like that. But, yeah, definitely the whole facility has a really, really dark, sour, ominous feel to it. I mean, okay, I would sort of describe it like, you know, this feeling that you have in church, that, you know, in a really good situation, you feel serene, you feel peaceful, you feel safe. The opposite of that. It's like you feel very watched, and you are. You feel like if you've ever come into a room right after like an argument, or like maybe you'd been at a party as a teenager and there'd been like a big fight and you walked in and it's like, man, what did I miss? The room feels really tense, even if there's not people in it. That's how a good portion of that place, especially the older sections, because they had changed out so many different sections to make room for other facilities. Okay, you'd have the main admin building. You would have, initially you had one cell house, two cell house. Well, they ended up making ended making three cell house, which is a seg that had death row, but they also had four cell house, and all that in the kitchen, that was all made around probably the 1930s. And at this time, things were still considered to be segregated. There's an area where it had whites only entrance, and they had kind of painted over it, but it still kind of seeps through. I mean, that's the thing about history. You can try to hoo-hoo it off, but it's going to seep out and people's going to know about it. But there was a floor 20 walk in Four Cell House. This area had always had a really, like a, how do I describe it? You know the feeling when you go over like a roller coaster hill or something, like when you're out in the county and just riding around as a kid? It's that same kind of roller coaster stomach feeling, and I never could understand what it was. I mean, there was inmate showers and washing machines and this and that, and I was talking to somebody about it, and I'd actually had an experience of seeing something on a camera. I had been working the control center for the cell house, which has a main control room, and you have cameras, or a monitor that shows the cameras coming in and off the front and back of each wall, and also it shows down in the shower area. Because of, obviously showers in prisons, sometimes things happen. Well, I saw something like a dimming, almost a flickering and then something midair, almost a swirl or like a distortion, almost like a heat coming off the ground. And then you would see what would seem to be a glow, like a pulsing fade in of a glow, not an orb, not like a dust cloud, but something that a solid plasma, like it contained in like a bubble. It was really strange. And it come up the hallway, and when I'm telling you this, sober as a judge, I don't smoke, I don't drink, any of that. It was maybe 10 o'clock at night. I was finishing up my shift on second shift, wide awake, cup of coffee, I was good. So this come up, and it would kind of sit there, and it would kind of change color slightly, and it would come closer to the camera. And as it came close to the camera, it was so bright that the outsides of the camera would dim because it was so strong. It was too much for the electronics in the camera. Well, the officer that was walking the walks was not right there for me to call him in there to look at it. Well, he was up on the upper floors. He'd come down, and by the time it was really getting close, I called him and said, "Hey, can you come down here for a minute?" And so he's walking his way down, but by the time he got to the base floor where the control center was, the orb or the glowing plasma, whatever it was, come up, kind of did a figure eight and shot out past the camera, and it almost had like a tail, almost like you'd see like a comet. It was so bright, it dimmed the camera off for a minute, and it faded right back in, and it was gone. And the officer come by, and I was like, he's like, "Well, what's going on?" I said, "You won't believe me." And he says, "Well, you said you look kind of spooked." And I said, "I see you're really watching the cameras. What's going on? Is there something I need to know about?" And he says, "Well, this is what I saw." So I told him what I saw, and he went, yeah, it sounds about right." And I said, "I'm not crazy." He said, "I'm not saying you're crazy." He said, "20 walk, right?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, that had been the old death row before, you know, they put it over in another cell house because death row was moved about four times." And I said, "Well, why was it down closer to that end part?" He says, "Well, that's where the access into the showers were. And back in the old days, when the original plumbing was put in, it wasn't vented properly, if at all. And the methane collected, and it moved just like creeping death, and it killed several inmates. And it was for a while before they could figure out what was wrong. And they said, ever since then, it's not felt right. I mean, not that there's a lot of feeling right in prison, but that definitely wasn't one of them." And that was just like, oh. And he's like, "Yeah, welcome to KSP. I had that experience. I hadn't been there 2 months."
Was that your first paranormal experience behind those walls?
Yeah, that's the one that really, I kind of get reflective about it because it's, when you say it out loud, I know it sounds nuts. And it's one of those things, you weren't there, you know, and that's it. If the guy had just told me, it's the old camera's acting up and whatnot, because he went there and checked it, and there was nobody awake, there was no hot pots on, nobody was smoking, nobody with like a soap bubble and blow smoke in it or make it up. There's nothing. Everybody was stone cold out and snoring. And no television on. There should have, because I'm thinking, could there have been cobweb that reflected the light so much away? You know, I'm trying to troubleshoot it. I'm not going, you know, boom, here's a ghost, here's a demon. You know, I'm not being that guy. I'm going, and tell me there's an explanation for this. And I just couldn't find it. And that is the story that I kind of was telling to the older officers. And that's when they're like, yeah. And then once they realized, well, yeah, he's seeing a few things too. Because not everybody sees that. And it's just the nature of it. The ones that did see, once they realized, oh, he can see it too, that's when they opened up to me. And then that's when I really started learning more about the weird spots in the penitentiary.
What were some of the follow-up stories that you heard from other officers about the penitentiary, or even experiences that you had yourself?
Well, there had been an infirmary, and again, the penitentiary's different areas move and grow as the gates went out further and got more fences, and they had different things. There had been an infirmary close to the top of the hill, and there had been a young inmate, and this was back in the times when, you know, if a person that, let's just say, was special needs or did not have the cognitive skills to maybe make better judgment calls, did some did something stupid, he would still end up there. And there's a young guy come in there, and these other guys saw a young, vulnerable man. And, it was prom night. I mean, there's no other way of saying it. It was prom night with this young guy, and they took advantage of him sexually, and to the point where he had to be put in the infirmary. Well, most convicts know, because there's a difference between a convict and an inmate. I don't know if you know this. Convicts basically know the code of, you don't snitch, don't do this and that, you do your time, and things come back on whoever, but you don't snitch on people. This kid was not, an inmate or a convict. He was an inmate. He's a fish. He just literally came into the system, and he was special needs, and they were afraid that he was going to tell on them because some of these guys were actually close to getting out, but they were still predators. Well, supposedly they set fire to the infirmary when it was on a holiday, and where a lot of times penitentiaries are always understaffed on holidays, and a bad fire broke out, and there were several inmates in there that were in there for various reasons. There was a orderly, which back in those days, you would have, a lot of times inmates would open the doors for the officers, let them come in and do their rounds, and they were called lock keys. It was back in a time when that was just how it was run, especially in the South. And this orderly, older fella, they called him Red. He was sort of kind of a Cajun, African-American guy. He ran in there trying to get everybody out, and he ended up helping get this kid out, which at first this kid was just all but catatonic and just was not able to move. He got the staff out, he helped everybody get out, and got the boy out, but because of all the smoke inhalation and all that, because those buildings had, the codes weren't there, he got, I guess, really bad lung respiratory issues in it, and he ended up dying. Well, they built a new facility, probably 1,000-2,000 feet, just to the east of that facility. But some of the medical gear, some of the mops and things, and all the sort of stuff that guy had used for, and he'd been in there for probably 50 years, 60 years. He'd come in there as a teenager, and like he'd shot a cop or a state trooper or something. Not saying he was a great guy, but I think he paid his dues. But anyway, people started noticing they would hear footsteps. And it's not just like a regular footsteps. It was from like the time of where they had the old wooden hill boots, like old-timey prison boots. Well, they would hear that, and they would begin hearing wop-pop, wop-pop, and a few steps, wop-pop, wop-pop. And some people had actually started trying to catch this, and they would see the locks, because there was feed tray locks on the door, so the inmates couldn't pass this and that or stab somebody if they were mentally challenged or just violent. And they would see this locks raise up for a second, almost like someone's checking it and dropping it. And this had happened several times. I've heard it myself. I had not seen that. I heard the footsteps, and I had a young officer call me. And I actually, I said, okay, what's going on? He said, I'm about ready to go. I'm about ready to go home. I said, well, what's going on? I knew this guy since he was a young kid, and he didn't scare. What's wrong? He said, you won't believe me. I said, try me. And it was so strange, because it was just like the situation I had. And he said, I'm hearing footsteps. And I said, but they're not like regular footsteps. He says, no. I said, almost sounds like it's, I said, is it kind of like a clop instead of a tap? And he said, yeah, like cowboy boots. I said, or like wooden, like the wooden heeled inmates, old timey boots. He's like, yeah, how do you know that? I said, yeah, I've been down there. He said, well, what, this is what I've heard. And then he told me about the chain or the lock smacking. And I said, yeah. Just ignored it. It'll probably be fine. Well, he went to the kitchen. There's a small kitchen area. He was making some coffee. And I said, if there's anything else going on, just tell him, hey, lay down. I've got it. Everything's fine. I'll check it. Thanks. I think they call him Red. I said, thanks, Red. Well, he went to the kitchen, and he was trying to make some coffee. And, like if someone, especially like old-timers, eat like a pork sandwich or something, they kind of suck on their teeth, trying to get the meat up between their teeth. He heard that right behind his back. Dropped his coffee, turned around, took a swing. There's nobody there. And he was so petrified, he couldn't leave the kitchen for a minute. And then he remembered what I said, and he kind of hollered out, says, I got this one, Red. good one, you got me. Do your thing, I've got it. And he said, after that, the rest of the night, he didn't have any problems, and he didn't really have any problems since then. I think it was almost like a, who are you? Why are you down here? Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like this thing didn't realize what was going on or whatever the energy was. Or it had just been a complete repeat of, you know, something that happened a long, long time ago. But, you know, there had been other situations where people have had phenomenon, and you just got to tell them, I've got this. Thanks. You have to kind of, you know, respect my authority. You know, you have to kind of say, look, guys, okay, I know you're there. I'm doing this. We got it. Thanks. You know, be respectful, and it stops. And I know that probably sounds goofy, but again, you have to be there. You have to see it. If you talk to other officers, you know, most people that were honest would say, yeah, that's right.
That concludes part one of our interview with Steve Asher about the Kentucky State Penitentiary. In part two, exclusively for Gravekeepers, we will discuss ghost stories from officers who've worked at the Kentucky State Penitentiary. How much of the activity is residual and how much is conscious? How do the inmates feel about the paranormal activity? To the stories involving the glowing severed head and other things from the past still occur to this day? Is there anything dark and evil lurking at the Kentucky State Penitentiary, and how one can tell the difference between something demonic and simply the spirits of a once horrible person still lurking in the halls? Also, what were some of the more disturbing paranormal images caught on security cameras at the Kentucky State Penitentiary? If you'd like to hear part two of the interview, please become a Gravekeeper and keep us on the air. Go to thegravetalks.com and click on the button that says become a Gravekeeper, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. It's only $5 a month, and you'll get access to every single advanced episode of the show as we create them, oftentimes months before they go public, as well as the bonus part two interviews that are always Gravekeeper exclusives. TheGraveTalks.com or Patreon.com/TheGraveTalks to access all of that and more. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.